From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Washington, D.C. is bracing for an impeachment trial and an inauguration unlike anything this country has witnessed. The inauguration will happen 2 weeks after a deadly riot in the U.S. Capitol building. Multiple government investigations are being opened into law enforcement's response to the riot.
Meanwhile, today, President-elect Joe Biden is staying focused on the pandemic. He'll lay out his plan to vaccinate 100 million people in his first 100 days in office. And last night, he unveiled a nearly $2 trillion plan to pay for it and to boost the economy.
My fellow Americans, the decisions we make in the next few weeks and months are going to determine whether we thrive in a way that benefits all Americans, or that we stay stuck in a place where those at the top do great, while economic growth for most everyone else is just a spectator sport.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. Hey, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Tolu Olorunpah, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, great to speak with you.
Great to speak with you as well.
And this is an ambitious plan. It includes money for direct payments to households, money for unemployment benefits, local governments, tax credits for child care, even a $15 minimum wage. Rick, start with you. How would you characterize what Biden is setting out to do here?
This is a major statement early on by the incoming Biden administration. This is not a series of half measures, and this is not limited even to COVID-19. This is a big, bold statement that President-elect Biden believes he has a mandate and wants to cash in on that and wants to do big things. And look, I heard that speech and heard language that was pretty close to what Bernie Sanders would use. And to me, it may be Vice President Biden learning some of the lessons of the Obama years, but of course he's looking for Republican votes, and that of course is a controversial notion inside the Democratic Party, particularly in this divided time. But the idea right now is to go big and go big early from Biden.
Tolu, a month ago, Congress could barely reach a deal that was more than half the cost of this plan. I know the balance of power is shifting in the Senate, so that might change things. But how is Joe Biden going to get this through Congress? Is he going to need Republicans, as Rick says?
Well, he definitely wants to have Republicans, but he has the nice added benefit of not necessarily needing very many Republicans and not needing Mitch McConnell to sign off on this. Mitch McConnell was not on board with spending almost $2 trillion just last month, but he's not going to have the gavel. In a matter of days, it's going to be Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Democrats in charge of the process, and they would be able to push forward this kind of major spending without having to rely on Republicans' veto power. Now, Joe Biden wants to push this through with, you know, enough votes to overcome any kind of a filibuster and get support from enough Republicans so that this has wide bipartisan support. That's probably why it's $1.9 trillion and not $2 or $3 or $4 trillion. But it's unclear if he'll be able to get that Republican support. We did see Mitch McConnell act during the Obama years as the stopgap measure, sort of to block anything that Obama was pushing, even though there was a crisis going on, with the idea that by, you know, blocking Obama, making it hard for him to push forward major legislation, then that was the pathway to get back into the majority. And Mitch McConnell did get back into the majority, and he kept that majority for the better part of 6 years. And he wants to get that majority back. So it would be hard to see, you know, Republicans en masse getting on board with what Biden has proposed, but he may be able to peel off a couple of them, and he is going to try to do that. And if he doesn't, he is going to be under pressure from members of his party and members of the progressive left to push forward as much as he can get with just the 50 Democratic votes plus the vice president-elect's vote to get it through using reconciliation or using any other measure that they can use to push through a partisan rescue package, given the fact that the economy continues to struggle and the virus continues to spread at record levels.
Rick Klein, I want to ask you about the prosecution of some of those who were involved in the insurrection or said to be involved in the insurrection on the Capitol. Last night on CNN, attorney Albert Watkins, who's representing the horned, shirtless rioter who calls himself the Q shaman, said that his client was only doing what the president wanted. Let's hear from him.
He felt like he was answering the call of our president. My client wasn't violent. He didn't cross over any police lines. He didn't assault anyone. He was there at the invitation of our president.
Well, that messaging is pretty clear. Lawyers for the rioters potentially, and I wonder what you think of this, could be helping the Democrats present their case in the Senate. What do you think?
I think it's fascinating to think about how information like that could be used as evidence against the president. If there is a decision to call witnesses or to involve statements like that into the record, of course, the president has done what he can to say that the people that marched on the Capitol were not his supporters. He addressed them just minutes earlier. And it is an interesting dynamic because it does hurt the president's legal defense, such as it is, that he had no responsibility, for what happened, when you have people who say, yeah, that's the reason I did it. He told me to do it. And the words will be very clear. I think the way that the Democrats, and it will be the Democrats, structuring this trial will be so interesting because they could go big with witnesses as they demanded and didn't get a year ago with the first Trump impeachment. And that would mean opening up a whole range of testimony, maybe even Vice President Pence testifying about his experience. And that would slow the process, but it would also potentially make it more compelling, the need to convict the president of the high crimes and misdemeanors that he now stands impeached of.
And how about on Trump's side? How big will his defense be, Tolu, and who's going to be arguing his case?
Well, as of now, he's having trouble finding credible lawyers to back him. Some of the White House counsel, people who were involved in his initial defense during his first impeachment, they want to have nothing to do with this current process. They don't want to defend his actions ahead of the riot. They don't want to defend his actions in terms of how he's tried to cast doubt on the legitimacy of the election. And he's having trouble finding lawyers that are willing to defend him. And also, he's going to be an ex-president, and he's not going to have access to this kind of taxpayer-funded representation that he currently has access to. So we hear names like Rudy Giuliani, people who are involved in the president's personal legal defense. It's a very small list of people that are considered, potential defenders of this president in an impeachment trial. There are some folks who have told the president to not even bother with the defense and just sort of, cast doubt on the legitimacy of this impeachment trial by not showing up, by not having lawyers show up. So it remains to be seen who is going to be the president's defender on this and how much he's going to try to defend himself, especially now that he does not have a social media account that he can use to try to speak publicly about his defense of his actions. But the president has been frustrated by the fact that very few credible lawyers have been willing to take up his case.
Tolu, he sure does seem pretty isolated in these final days of his term. What can you tell us about his state of mind and what we might expect from him between now and January 20th?
Well, the issue of people publicly defending the president is something that he has always been very aware of. He's watched very closely. And as he faces probably one of the biggest challenges of his term, he realizes that very few people are defending him. Very few people are going to the bat for him. And that is frustrating him. He realizes that there aren't very many people on television defending him. The press secretary is not going out and defending his conduct on a daily basis the way he probably would like. And that is leading to some level of frustration. And it is dawning on him that he only has 5 days left as president. He does not have very much power within the Republican Party. He's on very, tough terms with the vice president, who is, trying to, engage in the normal transition of power. Vice President Pence is going to be involved in the inauguration. He's going to attend the inauguration, unlike President Trump. And right now he's, maintaining a lot of the acts that you would expect from a president, while President Trump has largely checked out. So that's really his state of mind as he faces these final days in office.
Well, to your point that he is a weakened president, this week Republican Congressman Jim Jordan said, of course, Trump could still be an effective leader of the GOP after his term is over. But Rick, I know you've got some polling out today that says over half of Americans and 1 in 8 Republicans, which actually isn't that much, say Trump should be criminally charged for his role in the attacks. What are your polls telling you today?
Yeah, we had that finding. We had more than half thinking that he should be barred from holding office. But to the point that Congressman Jordan made, 60% of Republicans think that the Donald Trump direction is the right direction to go. And one number that just blows me away, 18%, 1 in 5 roughly, of Trump supporters think that the actions at the Capitol last week were justified. That is, again, mind-blowing. I mean, to think about what that means, the president has, of course, distanced himself from those acts, and I don't know many who would say publicly that that was a good thing, but the fact that one in five Trump voters think that it was justified is an astounding statistic and probably a sad statement on where we are in American politics, that so many Americans refuse to believe the truth, the facts that Donald Trump rightfully and legally lost the election.
And meanwhile, there's an NPR poll out today saying GOP women are Trump's staunchest defenders after the riot. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. Tolu Olorunapa is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
We know the risk factors for severe illness from the coronavirus: age, obesity, and a compromised immune system. But last month, the CDC added another risk. Individuals with Down syndrome also face increased risk of severe illness from COVID-19. And now the CDC is recommending those with comorbidities, including Down syndrome, get the vaccine early. We want to take a look at the reasons they are more at risk. And we're turning now to Joaquin Espinoza, who's executive director of the Linda Cernick Institute for Down Syndrome. Joaquin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How does Down syndrome put people more at risk of severe illness if they contract COVID-19?
Yes. Individuals with Down syndrome have many differences in their immune system. And their immune system is hyperreactive to viral infections. They get more complications when they are infected with viruses. So now the science shows that trisomy 21, the genetic condition that causes Down syndrome, is the top risk factor for severe COVID-19 symptoms.
So when you say severe COVID-19 symptoms, you're not saying that people with Down syndrome are more likely to contract COVID-19 in the first place, but they're more likely to become sicker.
Correct. There is no evidence that they are infected at a higher rate. But when the infection is confirmed, they are four times more likely to be hospitalized and 10 times more likely to die of complications from the infection.
There was a study published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that looked at COVID-19 data from the United Kingdom. That was an important study. What did it find?
They found that even after adjusting for these other risk factors that you mentioned earlier, obesity, age, even when you account for all those variables, Down syndrome per se confers this much increased risk of both hospitalization and mortality.
And have you been keeping track? I mean, when you say that there is evidence that they're more likely to become sick and even die from it, do you keep track of incidents of this? Do you know how often this is happening around the country?
Yes, we're monitoring various databases, including one of the largest databases in the USA called the National COVID-19 Cohort Collaborative. We're tracking the numbers, and they seem to repeat the trends seen in the data from Europe. We also have many other scientific lines of evidence suggesting that individuals with Down syndrome will go into this hyperinflammation, this super response to the virus that will create a number of complications. And we here at the Cernick Institute have been investigating this type of immune dysregulation for many years now.
And for those people who have someone with Down syndrome in their family or in their circle of friends, how difficult is it to try to keep them safe from the virus?
To clarify, you know, when a person with Down syndrome contracts SARS-CoV-2, it's not a death sentence. It's just that there's an increased risk of hospitalization and mortality. I think the community has been very, very good in working together to get this information out there and make sure that individuals with Down syndrome adopt those extra measures, that extra caution.
So it's not a death sentence if someone with Down syndrome contracts COVID-19. The CDC, though, has recommended that individuals with comorbidities get the vaccine early. That now includes people with Down syndrome. It's just a recommendation, though. Are you urging states to follow through and get people with Down syndrome higher priority on the vaccination line?
I think the data is definitive to adopt the recommendation that individuals with Down syndrome be given priority. To give you an example, the increased risk conferred by Down syndrome in terms of COVID-19 hospitalization and mortality is equivalent to adding 40 years to your birth certificate. Individuals with Down syndrome in their 40s and 50s are seeing rates of hospitalization and mortality similar to the general population in their 80s and 90s.
Are you lobbying states now to try and get people with Down syndrome the vaccination early?
Our partners at the Global Down Syndrome Foundation, the key advocacy organization that works with the Cernic Institute, has been working with many other advocacy organizations, and now the work ahead is to ensure that the various states also adopt the CDC guidelines.
That's Joaquin Espinoza, Executive Director of the Linda Cernic Institute for Down Syndrome. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
The country is dangerously divided, and tension ahead of next week's inauguration is buzzing like an electric wire through the Capitol. A nationwide public radio project called America Amplified spent the past tumultuous year bringing people together to talk about their vision for the country. Joining us now to share some of the voices is the project's senior producer, Andrea Tudhope. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you.
And you've been talking with people for a year about the divisions in this country, and then the insurrection and impeachment happens, and now you've gone back to reconnect with some of the people you spoke with. What did you hear from them?
I think there's exasperation on both sides, as well as disappointment. I've heard feelings that more violence is on the way, questions about wishing we could get the full story. And along those lines, another thing I heard, and this is from people across the political spectrum, distrust in the media. And it's a big part of the reason we started America Amplified. We wanted to support local journalists to help build trust. And then in the fall, we launched a national talk show. And that's where I met Cecilia Johnson. She was a guest on one of our shows. She's a Black woman here in Kansas City, Missouri, staunch Trump supporter. She said she was disappointed at first about the insurrection at the Capitol, but she sat with those feelings and kind of came around. Let's take a listen.
I completely understand why people are frustrated, why people are upset, just as I understood. And we watched the early middle of last year. We watched people, you know, practically burning cities down because they were upset. And the only difference is I think that this group geared their frustration towards the people they felt were really the problem instead of innocent people, innocent business owners and things of that nature.
That's very interesting because many Republicans and Republican lawmakers are echoing what she's saying, and Democrats are making the case. I think what she's referring to there is comparing the attack on the Capitol with Black Lives Matter protests in the summer. Democrats are saying you can't do that. I mean, what are you hearing about that?
Well, I checked in with a Democrat, Allie Young. She's a Navajo woman living just outside the Navajo Nation in New Mexico. She was involved in getting out the vote in her native communities back in the fall. When we met in November after the election, she was really celebrating after a record turnout of Native voters and celebrating the Biden win. I talked with her this week, and she and her fellow community organizers have lost a lot of that celebratory feeling. And really, it's been clouded by disappointment, namely in how the majority white crowd at the Capitol were treated by law enforcement compared to how majority Black and brown protesters were treated over the summer. And here's some of what she shared with me.
My community, those I've worked with, also other communities of color that really do feel like if nothing's going to be done, we're not voting anymore, you know? And it's those feelings of losing hope in a way, feeling like I wanted to give up on the work because, you know, to me, it was like, what's the point in fighting when it's never going to be fair for us?
That's fascinating. And it would be a very big problem for Democrats if people who were energized by this election somehow feel like they don't want to participate in the next. A big part of the work that you did over the past year was to facilitate conversations with people who disagree about politics and race. What's your takeaway from that work? Did you find that you ended up making any connections with people that changed the way that they thought or that they voted?
Yeah. We met a woman named Meadow Kaufeld. She's a white woman in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. She is a wildlife biologist. She's pro-guns, pro-choice. Mm. She's a Republican these days. But in our first listening session, she got to have a one-on-one conversation with a Black woman in Georgia about racism. And I checked in with Meadow a few weeks or maybe a few months after that session, and she described to me that that was a really eye-opening experience, that she had sort of a reckoning. And I did check in with her this week, and she said that she's feeling pretty worried about this moment, that it's too extreme, that it's inciting violence. And here's some of what she had to say.
you go too far in one direction and sometimes things become acceptable that wouldn't be otherwise. And I know that's an extreme thought, but that is my fear, is that, you know, something like that might happen here in the United States.
Andrea, it's so important to hear these voices from people of different backgrounds all across the country. And I know you asked a really interesting question throughout this process. What does it mean to be an American? You asked that of people, and I just wonder what kind of answers you got at this troubled time.
I'll tell you this, there was no easy answer to that question. I asked Mikus Mays that question this week. He was a guest on our show. He's a young Black man from Memphis, a senior at Savannah State University in Georgia. He identifies as either a conservative Democrat or liberal Republican. Specifically, I asked him if the past year challenged his idea of what it is to be American. Let's take a listen.
It definitely has. If I'm being honest, your talk show actually led me to different viewpoints, because one thing I realized hearing the other participants talk were that other people have other problems. So it's not just my problems that are important, but everybody's problems are important, and that we need to focus on everybody's problems instead of just one group's. And hopefully by doing that, we can come to a better understanding of each other.
You know, I think he touches on something that we heard a lot, that being American in his mind is being able to look each other in the eye, accept one another's faults, and work together. I think we're hearing a lot right now that not a lot of people are ready to heal unless we're ready to kind of dig into our wounds to move forward.
Right, and to hear him say that these conversations led him to different viewpoints feels important in this time as well. Andrea Tudhope, senior producer at America Amplified, a public radio project that's been out talking with Americans about the state of our country. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
President-elect Joe Biden is calling on Congress to approve a $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief plan when he takes office next week. The American Rescue Plan, as it's called, spreads that funding across a number of areas. It includes more financial support to keep families and businesses afloat until COVID-19 vaccines are more widely distributed. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you again. Joe Biden's plan includes direct payments of $1,400 to most Americans, and that brings the total amount to $2,000, including December's $600 checks. How much is that expected to help Americans in a meaningful way?
Yeah, so for the overall economy, it's bound to produce a big boost. Of course, the real issue is that there are many people who don't desperately need that extra $1,400. And there are others who obviously need a lot more than that. But, you know, the plan clearly wants to just get this emergency money out the door quickly. For those who are really struggling, there are several other components of the bill that, Lisa, should be very helpful for the people struggling the most.
And the other parts of the bill, meaning what are you referring to?
Well, mainly the increase in the federal unemployment benefit to $400 from $300 a week, and extending those payments that in many cases were expired in December for example, for gig workers and that sort of thing. Also, the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures has been extended till September. So in addition to the stimulus cash, these measures are really targeted at the people who are unemployed and really struggling the most in this environment.
And in fact, we heard a report today that 965,000 Americans filed for first-time unemployment benefits just last week as the job market shrinks even more because of the coronavirus. Joe Biden is hoping to get bipartisan support for his plan, even though some Republicans were hesitant to approve more spending back in December. What are economists saying about the need for more relief from the government?
Yeah, so most economists are expecting a really big snapback in the economy and an improved job market later in the year once the rollout of the vaccine sort of reaches critical mass. But obviously getting from here to there is the hard part. And there's sort of a wide variety of ideas among economists about the best way to do that. But I think the exercise being done now is trying to figure out how much of this bill actually stands a chance of being enacted, because some of it is going to be very controversial among Republicans. Our economists at Bloomberg are estimating it'll likely be sort of whittled down to something in the vicinity of $1 trillion in spending by the time it's approved.
And meanwhile, the package is the first of two major economic spending proposals that Biden is expected to seek in the first few months of his presidency. Do we know anything about the plans for the second?
Right. So this plan is really just emergency sort of Band-Aid for the economy now in the middle of the virus. Biden's agenda, of course, is more ambitious, especially when it comes to things like improving and fixing the infrastructure of the country and transitioning towards clean, green energy. So I think a lot of people are expecting that second bill to sort of go into those issues more in depth than this one does.
All right. Thank you. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you.
This is the sound of the Barents Sea, about 200 miles north of Siberia. You can hear the gush of waves about 4 feet high, crashing onto the side of an expedition boat. On board that boat was journalist Andrea Pitzer, four Russian sailors, and some scientists from Norway. The force of the waves was similar to what the Dutch explorer William Barents and his crew experienced when they ventured to the Arctic in the late 1500s. They were searching for a northeast polar passage to open up trade from Europe to China. Andrea Pitzer traveled to the Arctic three times to research her book, which is just out this week. It's called Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. Andrea, that is no pleasure ride. It's hard to not get seasick even just listening to it. Maybe it was pleasurable at the time, I'm not sure, but it was a party compared to what William Barents faced on his first voyage in 1594. Andrea Pitzer, he made three voyages in all. What was the purpose?
All the voyages were, in one way or another, to try to find a trade route to China. On the first one, in 1594, he was turned back by ice north of the Russia and coastline. On the second one, they went a little farther south and had to turn back again by ice. The third time he sailed, in 1596, he was one of just a two-ship tiny fleet that ended up only one ship by the time they got there, and they ended up having to stay the winter about 200 miles above the Russian mainland.
So where did he start off from, and how did he get where he was going?
He sailed from Amsterdam north up over Scandinavia and then east across the sea that today bears his name, the Barents Sea, and to a long, thin pair of islands called Nova Zembla, Novaya Zemlya in Russian today. And part of the first expedition was to determine if that might even be attached to a whole polar continent that we didn't know about.
Let's just say you, of course, your trips there revealed much, but you were also using primary source material, such as Barents' own ship log.
Yes, there was actually an account of his three voyages that was translated into English more than 400 years ago. And I worked off that and off a Dutch account that I had translated from Old Dutch of someone who was on the first two voyages. So it's just piecing together all these little elements and then going there myself. Using all that, I tried to sort of paint a picture of their whole story.
And tell us as much as you can about his story. On their third expedition, this is the winter of 1596, William Barents and his men became stranded for the winter. How did they become stranded and what did they do to survive?
Well, the same thing happened on all three expeditions. They basically went as far as they could until they were stopped by ice. And like the first two, they turned for home when they couldn't go further east. But this time, by the time they turned back, they were unable to make it back. And let me say, this was still summer. This was August. This tells you how much ice there was back then. And they sailed a few days trying to get around the ice and then realized finally on September 11th in 1596 that they were stuck for the winter. And they began to carry their goods to the shore, and they began to think about building a cabin. And unfortunately, the first thing that happened was the carpenter died. So they had a big task set before them, but they did manage to build a cabin and fight off polar bears while they were doing it. And it was in that cabin that they ended up spending almost 10 months.
This is how many people in the cabin?
At this point, 16 people.
How did they survive?
They trapped foxes, which had just enough vitamin C in them to keep scurvy from killing them during that winter. They ate their rations. They dug out and had to drag sleds miles to get driftwood for firewood in order to stay alive. They had more than an inch of ice on the inside walls of their cabin. It was an unbelievably grueling affair, and they often were their own worst enemies. They nearly poisoned themselves by burning coal in their closed-up cabin. They ate polar bear liver at one point, and their skin peeled off from head to toe, and three of them almost died. So it was really a day-to-day battle to live in this place that was not on any map in existence at the time.
And what was it like to find the site of the cabin? And tell us what was there. And what we're hearing now is the audio that you recorded of the gravel underfoot as you're approaching the site of the cabin. And this, again, is a couple hundred miles above Siberia. What's it like as you're walking?
Well, it's this really long, low, desolate view, this gravelly beach, and then a slight incline up to a little plateau. And that's where they ended up building their cabin. It was exposed to wind on three sides and bitter snow that ended up piling up over the roof with polar bears rampaging on the roof trying to get in. But what's left today is just a few of the base logs that formed the very bottom of the cabin. Most everything else has been pulled out through various archaeological digs over the last 130 years or so and is in various museums. But every now and then, people find other little relics. And you can still see the long logs that formed the rectangle for the base. For me, it was really useful to be able to go and stand there and just look out to sea and see the view that would have been just filled with ice at the time, that they would come out day after day and realize how far they were from home.
And along with the encounters with polar bears and the wild there, they saw walruses. And this is something you and the sailors on board the boat saw as well. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was the first time that this particular crew had seen walruses, but they had heard that their tusks were valuable. So they had heard of them. And their first reaction at this place called the Orange Islands was to go overboard into a small boat and try to kill as many as possible to get their tusks. And it was pretty incredible because I had known about this place in the journals. And when we got there on our boat, there were hundreds of walruses on the beach in just the same place. And we didn't have the same reaction, but I was kind of awestruck watching the walruses. And the walruses sat and stared at us for a couple minutes. And then one of the sailors who plays an accordion thought to get his accordion. And he came out and began playing an old Soviet era waltz. And the walruses came and gathered and watched a concert while he played. And I have to say, it was one of the most amazing things that I ever saw.
And there's a fantastic video that you have of it, and we'll make a link on our website. But let's listen to a bit of it now. The walruses are kind of having a good time. They're sort of enjoying the music.
They really were. They were staring right at us. They were transfixed, and I guess that's how they play, but they were sort of leaping over each other and knocking into each other. And I know that they're actually very dangerous animals. One of, not this crew, but another group, sank a boat the size of ours like 2 weeks later. So I know that they can be actually quite dangerous, but it was clear there in the moment that they were really enjoying the performance.
So William Barents's expeditions resulted in the permanent opening of the High Arctic to Europeans. Could you tell us what that meant for the world?
Whalers ended up in the places, particularly Svalbard, north of Norway, that Barents had discovered. And whaling became a huge industry. And particularly by the middle of the 19th century, you have European nations wiping out nearly whale populations up there. It's this just harvest of slaughter that some whale populations have not yet recovered from and may never recover from. And it's also sort of from this era of colonialism where you already had Spain in the Americas and over in the East, But now it's clear many other countries are going to get involved in this search. And the whole world is going to come under this boot heel of colonialism. And that's going to be the Industrial Revolution. And that's going to be climate change. And that's going to be what's affecting the Arctic so much today. And I saw a lot of things already changed just from my three trips up there.
Such as what?
On the first expedition, there was an ice cave we went to that had probably been there for hundreds of years, and there was rain in January, and part of it melted and caved in. We were briefly trapped a little bit. It wasn't anything too serious, but we were all aware that it's not supposed to rain in the Arctic in January. On the second trip, I was astounded by the amount of trash I saw, plastic trash on the shores of the Arctic, just everywhere. And on the third trip, I saw an island that didn't even exist in human knowledge until about 3 years ago, when a glacier retreated so far that it revealed there had been an island off the shores of Nova Zembla this entire time. So it was really concrete ways, not just temperature, but the results of those temperature changes.
So as if you didn't go through enough on your first three trips there, you're going back to the Arctic in August. Why?
I just don't think there's a bigger story that we have to tell than what's happening there and what's happening with climate in the world right now. This time, I've been studying Russian. I've been studying cold water diving. I'll go as a sailor on the boat. And my goal in the next few years is to come back with several stories of what happened there in the past, sort of these people that we turned into legends, maybe in some ways that will teach us about why that's not the healthiest thing to do. I'd like to go back not just for history, but also to come back with stories of the very important things that are happening in the Arctic today.
Well, I hope you'll tell them to us. Thank you so much. The book is called Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World by journalist Andrea Pitzer. Andrea, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Lisa.
East of Phoenix, Arizona, the Tonto National Forest is home to a site that is sacred to the San Carlos Apache tribe. But underneath that sacred ground is a treasure, one of the largest copper deposits in North America. A land swap between the U.S. government and a private mining company has been fast-tracked in the last days of the Trump presidency. And yesterday, a native group filed a lawsuit in an 11th-hour attempt to stop the new mine from breaking ground. Deborah Utasia Kroll is a reporter with the Arizona Republican. She's been following this story. Deborah, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Peter.
Sure. In 1955, President Eisenhower tried to protect this land from mining, but then fast forward 1995, a huge copper deposit is found in this area known as Oak Flat. And today we're on the verge of the land swap being approved so the mining project can move forward. What can you tell us about this mine and who's behind it?
Well, the mine is owned by Resolution Copper, which is a subsidiary of Rio Tinto, a British-Canadian-Australian firm. It's also partially owned by BHP Billiton, which is also a British-Australian firm. It's important to note that copper has actually been mined in the area for more than 100 years. The issue is that the way that Resolution wants to mine this particular ore discovery is a method called block cave mining, in which a shaft is dug and then they're going to dig very methodically underneath the ore body. And as they dig, they are saying that the land will collapse upon itself, and then the resulting rubble will be collected and sent through another pipeline to where the copper ore can be extracted from the rock.
And that is why, I'm just going to say, that's why environmental groups are so angry. That's also one of the reasons why indigenous groups are so upset, because it will destroy the land in that way. But I just want to also point out that the state of Arizona, any kid who grew up here knows that the state has five C's, right? Copper, cattle, cotton, citrus, and climate. Just give me a sense of the economic picture and what this new copper mine would mean to the economy.
Well, Resolution Copper estimates that once the construction is done, the construction, of course, will involve thousands of workers and inject money into the economy. Once that's done, they expect to employ about 1,400 to 1,500 people annually for a period of 40 to 50 years. Now, jobs in that part of the state are highly sought after. because as we all know, copper either goes up or it goes down. So anything that'll keep people employed for that period of time is something that the state is really interested in promoting.
Hmm. And as we said, this region is sacred to the San Carlos Apache. What are you hearing from them about what this mine would mean for their way of life and for their culture?
Now, Oak Flat is one of those places that, as Wenzler Nosey told me on my last visit there 2 days ago, it's one of those places that has been touched by God. And the destruction of that will destroy a huge part of the Apache religion and deny them a place to engage in certain ceremonies. I think for a non-Indian, the closest parallel would be the Shrine of Lourdes in France. Say the mining company came to the people of Lourdes and said, hey, we discovered gold underneath and we want to get that gold because we need gold in this, in our economy. Unfortunately, Lourdes will have to be destroyed. So that's the type of parallel that they are drawing here. These are places that cannot be moved. You can move a brick and mortar church. You cannot move Lourdes. You cannot move Oak Flat.
So what kind of protests do they have planned here as this moves forward? Are we looking at something like the next Standing Rock?
If they can get enough people onto the land, I would say that there may very well be another Standing Rock. Right now, there's probably only about 10 or 12 people there full-time. And, of course, the leader of Apache Stronghold, Wenzler Nosey, has been living there in a teepee for about 14 or 15 months. And he said he's not leaving. So we'll have to see what happens if they can get the critical mass to get thousands and thousands of people occupying what is right now an unimproved Forest Service campground.
We don't have a lot of time, but the clock does seem to be ticking on this lawsuit. What's next here?
What's next is that the judge in the case has denied their request for an immediate temporary restraining order. However, he has acknowledged that because the clock will start ticking, the government has up to 60 days to convey title to resolution, that he says this is going to require an expedited hearing. The hearing on this will be January 27th in the Federal District Court.
Let's leave it there. Deborah Utasia-Kroll, reporter with the Arizona Republic, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.